FM, your very best source for progressive programming.
From New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. I'm on location, helping people on a journey of health and happiness and longevity. I'm seeing some remarkable results. And most of the people listen to the radio program from around the United States. And it's interesting to get their perspective, what they pay attention to, what they actually apply from what they hear. And I would suggest that about 5% of what I share, they actually use. Because I have a chance to discuss what your diet like. Do you exercise? How do you deal with stress? And yet every single show, I always start with anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes on the things that we can all apply from around the world. And for those of you who live outside the United States, here's a question for you. How much do you imagine, a guesstimate, you use on a daily basis? Whether it's exercise or diet changes or supplements or herbs or any form of holistic practice, let me know. I'd like to share it with the audience. And it would give us a perspective if it's universal or if it's something unique in America that we don't apply, but a very small percentage of what's available to us. You can email me your insights at prnstudio@gmail.com. That's prnstudio@gmail.com. I'll share the results with the audience. Today, we're going to start with a study from McMaster's University about green tea. I always recommend decaffeinated green tea. People don't realize you can get 25 to 50 milligrams in a normal cup. Well, let's say you're taking two or three cups at several hundred milligrams a day. That can create a hyperactivity, and even when you want to be relaxed or still, you find it difficult because your body's revving. That's what caffeine does. And also, if you take it in the evening, and some people do, not good. So take the decaffeinated. In any case, they found that green tea extracts deliver a molecular punch, and that in turn disrupts the formation of neurotoxic elements in the body. So when you think of Alzheimer's disease, that's a real, real problem in the brain. And it's inflammatory. You want to turn off inflammation. Well, green tea turns off inflammation, and curcumin turns off inflammation also. Vitamin C turns off inflammation, vitamin E and coenzyme Q10. These are all great anti-inflammatories. Magnesium turns off inflammation. So the more anti-inflammatories we're putting into our body, the more inflammation is being reduced in our joints, our muscles, our eyes, helping us prevent macular degeneration, and in the brain. So this study is all about how you really help yourself, especially with Alzheimer's, and improve cognitive decline. You improve it substantially. Later today, not during this hour, but in the following hour on our sister station, WBAI, I'm going to present something no one's ever done before, ever, in the history of radio. And I'm not going to say anything more than that, but it deals with Alzheimer's. And something that happened this morning, wow, really got my attention. I'll tell you that's something very positive. Anyway, I like it when there's a breakthrough, but I'm talking about a big-time breakthrough. And you'll have a chance to know what that is in the next hour. But in any case, if you take the EGCG, that's EGCG, that is the molecular component within green tea that coats the toxic particles and then neutralizes them. So one more way that we're learning how green tea works in the body. And this was published in the American Chemical Society Journal. Also, we're finding that in many cases, people can improve chronic disease if they understand what happens in the body. This is from the University of Liverpool. They found the chronic disease risk goes way up when you're inactive. How long does it take before you really are promoting disease because of your sedentary lifestyle? 14 days, just 2 weeks. Now, it's no secret we lead a much more sedentary life than those of our ancestors. But we're paying a price for it. With the U.S. Center for Disease Control reporting that 2 out of 3 Americans are either overweight or obese, 2/3. And that puts them immediately at an increased risk of chronic disease like heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. Now, a new British study showcases a harmful metabolic change that occurs within a mere 14 days of inactivity. And even if those who are inactive are young and fit. So let me explain this. So even if you're young, even if you had been athletic, if you have not been working out for 14 days, you're promoting disease. And they were just staggered by this. That is a big deal. So that's why every day, or at least 6 days a week, you should be doing an hour of exercise that will reduce your body mass index. It reduces your opportunity for diabetes and heart disease. Because historically, I know athletes, now think of this for a moment, it was right in front of us for decades. The athletes who had the longest athletic careers were the ones who kept themselves in shape 12 months a year. But almost all sports, baseball, basketball, football, soccer, they're seasonal, maybe 4 months, sometimes 5 months. But then what do they do out of season? Well, historically, they didn't do anything with the idea that you didn't have to, that because you had been active and in shape for half the year, you could take the other half of the year off. Now we're seeing why a lot of those people had such really disastrous results. They got weight, they got bellies, and then that made it more difficult each year to get back into shape. Now, today's athletes know that they want to stay in shape 12 months a year. They're doing a lot more today than what was ever done historically. And, of course, they then have an opportunity to have a longer career. But this is also saying if you're out of exercise for 14 days, you're already promoting disease. Forget 3 months or 6 months. So just keep that in mind. One more reason why good science shows us that we've got to keep active all the time. Now, one exercise probably done by more people than any other exercise in the world is Tai Chi. Tai, T-A-I, Chi, C-H-I. Chi is life force. It's a very slow, rhythmic meditation. Historically, it was it also allowed for self-defense, but most people never used it for self-defense, just a way of keeping the body loose and limber, and especially those who maybe didn't want to do yoga. Now there's new research showing that Tai Chi holds promise as cardiac rehab exercise. This is from the Warren Alpert School of Medicine at Brown University. This very slow and gentle movement is optimal, especially for people who are in cardiac rehabilitation. This was published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. And they found that after a heart attack, more than 60% of patients decline participation in cardiac rehabilitation. Although the reasons include they can't afford it or the distance to a rehab center. Now here's something that doesn't cost you anything, and it works. And it's especially good for people who have high-risk behavior. Quote, we thought that Tai Chi might be a good option for those people because you can start very slowly and simply, and as their confidence increases, the pace movements can be modified to increase intensity. This is the MD, PhD, lead author of this study. And it says that Tai Chi exercise can reach low to moderate intensity levels, the emphasis on breathing and relaxation. So that's something else for any of you who want a safe, easy, but very beneficial way when you're in post-heart rehab. And there's probably a million people a year in the United States in this. From the University of Washington, a study on the cannabinoid benefits and mechanisms shown with Dravet syndrome in this laboratory study. One more study showing the benefits of the cannabinoids, and this one on a genetic condition. This was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And I've seen epilepsy, seizures, migraines, brain cancers, lung cancers, all reversed, cured with the cannabinoids. So, something to consider. Exposure to environmental chemicals is an important risk factor for breast cancer. This is from Silent Spring Institute. First, the larger picture. We're all exposed all the time if we live in, let's say, industrial environments in urban areas, by lawn sprays and pesticides and all the other chemicals that we're exposed to in suburbia. And then on commercial farms, you're really exposed to a lot. I remember when Cesar Chavez was leading the movement in California to reform farming practices to help give people who were making all the money, the industrial farmers, give the worker a more fair living wage. They never did. He got it raised somewhat, but they did improve some of the conditions. And without him, it would have been even worse. And I was out there at the time, and I was interviewing hundreds of the farmers. And you talk with them, and they'll pull up a pants leg and show you all these blisters and sores, ones that will never heal, because they were exposed to the pesticides. Their children have a higher incidence of blood cancers, leukemias, lymphomas. So it's no secret, but we like to think, well, that's if you're working or living beside a farm. No, it's not. The reality is exposure to environmental chemicals, especially early in life, is an important contributing factor to the development of breast cancer. And that's according to the most comprehensive review of human studies to date. And the findings should inform what preventative strategies can reduce the incidence of this disease, including worldwide. And in 2007, researchers from Silent Spring Institute published in the journal Cancer a landmark state-of-the-art science review of the link between environmental science, environmental chemicals, and breast cancer. They identified 216 chemicals that cause mammary tumors in animals and humans to develop cancer. Quote, this was a real wake-up call. And now, 10 years later, we see the evidence is even stronger. Well, what she means is that since the first review, hundreds of studies have been published on environmental chemicals and breast cancer. And to capture and synthesize the human evidence, the team conducted a systematic review of the scientific literature. They looked at 158 epidemiological studies in the last 10 years. And it's really frightening. This was published in the current issue of the journal Environmental Research. The dioxins, the DDTs, the highly fluorinated chlorine, PFOSA, airborne pollution. There's almost a 500% increase in breast cancer if you're exposed to these chemicals. Let's just put it in real simple language. During the so-called window of susceptibility, the body is changing, and breast cells are dividing quickly, and the breast tissue becomes vulnerable to damage from chemicals. And so when you're driving around, let's say in an urban environment, as people do in cabs of their cars or subway trains or buses, you adapt to the chemicals in the air. Some you can see, some you can smell. Others, but they're particulate matters, and they're lodging in our body. And when you're younger, they're lodging also in the breast tissue. We're just not doing any studies to validate that, but they're there. So the more pollutants you are exposed to, paints and varnishes and outgassing from carpets and particle boards that are used in most of people's cupboards and desks and chairs, and the particle board floors they have now, those laminates, all of those are made from chemicals that outgas. And you breathe them in. And then that causes disruption at the chemical level. So for those people who have been trying to live a reduced chemical-sensitive lifestyle, all the more reason to go for your organic non-sprayed produce, to go for locally grown produce, to drink clean water that you either mineral water or filtered water that doesn't have all the chemicals in it. You can have over 200 different chemicals, including medicines, including chemotherapy and antipsychotic medication and AZTs, drugs, in your drinking water, and there's nothing that can filter them out from your commercial tap. The city can't do it. Some of these molecules are below their capacity to be filtered, but they're still there. They're lodging in your body. They're accumulating. Parts per billion can't be filtered, but they can still be dangerous. So we end up ingesting each day at least 200 to 250 different toxic chemicals into our body. So when you're then conscious of this, and you put an air filter in your home, and you put plants in your home that absorb these toxins and give you clean oxygen instead, when you're juicing with green juices, and you want to clean this out of the body, and you take your curcumin at 1,000 milligrams, and you're taking your green tea at 500 milligrams, and you're taking your vitamin C at 5,000 milligrams, then you're helping, as these chemicals do go in the body, to dislodge them, to encapsulate them, what is called chelation, coming from chele, the Greek word for claw-like, and you take these out of the body. Yeah, you're exposed, but you're not having the damage from the exposure. Then you're taking your greens, chlorophyll, spirulina, chlorella, wheatgrass. These are the really supercharged detoxifying agents, and they're taking the greens are taking the chemicals out. Then you add in ginger, garlic, onion, and lemon, and that is enormously powerful, repairing the damage that's been done. So I'm not suggesting, and it's impractical and imprudent, to suggest that we should be hypersensitive to our environment to the point of being phobic. That's ridiculous. We're going to live in a world that is polluted. We're going to be around situations where we cannot control everything. But we can do our best to minimize our exposure. You can stay non-toxic in a toxic world. You can stay happy around sad, angry people. You can be constructive when others are being destructive. It's not one or the other, either or. So now the word is to all women in this audience and to the men who have women in their lives and care for them on a daily basis, if the women will just do the following. If you take a smoothie in the morning and one in the afternoon and you put in a tablespoon of chlorophyll and spirulina and ginger juice and vitamin C, and then you drink that throughout the day, even when you're exposed to chemicals, you're substantially, radically reducing the negative impact of those chemicals on your body. But if you're not doing that, then according to this article in Environmental Research done at the Silent Spring Institute, you are making your breast cells more susceptible, as much as 500% more susceptible to breast cancer. So it's worth trying that. And also, when I work with people, which I do every day, I always start with, what is the object of the exercise? What are you trying to achieve? And if you're trying to achieve ideal health, then you have to look also at any of the traumatic events in your life and what impact they may have had on you, both emotionally and physically. Because though we can never erase anything from our mind, and this supercilious notion of just, well, let it go, you can't. Nothing in life is ever forgotten. It's always there. The key is don't energize it. Don't empower it. Empower that which you want. And where you put your focus, your conscious energy, is what you're empowering. So if I want to empower healing, I have to put my energy on healing, not diseasing. If I have a disease, and if my disease is taking up all my emotional space, if I'm absolutely focused on what happens with cancer, am I going to die? How long will it take to die? What will I look like when I'm dying? Will I have any way of reversing it? All the thoughts that go through people's minds when they have a disease. Then that suddenly becomes the dominant energy in your life. That turns off your DNA from healing and turns on your DNA from diseasing. So traumatic events are important that we deal with them in a constructive and positive way. And I've noticed, and I'm sure many of you who are in the healing field have noticed, that traumatic events really take a toll on your heart. Now, a new study just published from the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine says, quote, traumatic events take a toll on the heart. Today it seems about everything has been shown to lead to heart disease. And of course, smoking, yes. High blood pressure, yes. Being overweight, absolutely. But there is mounting evidence that psychosocial factors can cause heart problems as well. A new study demonstrates how traumatic experiences can affect vascular health and ultimately heart disease. The study results will be presented at the North American Menopause Society annual meeting this week. Now, heart disease is the leading cause of death in women. And according to the American Heart Association, every 60 seconds in the U.S., someone's mother, wife, daughter, or sister dies from a form of heart disease. And to date, little research has been done to study the impact of traumatic experiences on vascular health as a precursor to heart disease. Even less work has focused on the relationship during the menopause transition when the risk of heart disease is naturally increasing, along with deteriorating endothelial function, which is the endothelium, as you well know now, is the inner lining of the heart and blood vessels. In this study of perimenopausal and postmenopausal women, non-smoking women, they tested whether a greater number of lifetime traumatic experiences was related to poor endothelial function and independent demographic characteristics other than heart disease risk factors, estradiol or childhood abuse, abuse history. And the result was that women reporting a higher number of traumatic experiences, three or more, in their whole life, had poor endothelial function, which then makes you far more susceptible to a heart attack. So that's important. So what's the solution? Well, I've got a couple. When I next have a health support group, I'm going to make one specifically and exclusively for 3 months, overcoming lifetime traumatic events and measured by an increased health of the heart and the endothelial, because we can actually measure these today. And I'm going to also add to this women who have been formerly incarcerated, because we don't do anything for the women in prison, which is a disgrace. We should. And so I'm going to take 100 women to 500 women, the maximum 500, and I'm going to create an anti-traumatic or trauma recovery protocol that is working on the subconscious and will reverse heart disease and repair damage to the arteries, and measure that against a group of women who have not been incarcerated, so I can show the difference, and for the first time, because this has never been done, show that we should be providing all men and especially women with health protocols for dealing with the psychosocial impact on their bodies of being incarcerated. And I'm going to do that in the near future. I'm finishing up a lot of stuff right now. I'm finishing up a cookbook for the spring. I'm finishing a new special, a television special. I'm finishing a new documentary. And I'm doing a health support group. I've got a group of people for a month I'm working with to help them reverse addictive behavior and repair that whole part of the psyche. And all this is just in this four-week period. So within the next month or two, I'll put together a protocol. And then at that time only, not before, because we won't be back in the city before then, I want to see if we can't do something to help women and men, and also to help women and who've been incarcerated overcome trauma. Because right now, we're not. And right now, that trauma is taking a toll on people's health, and it shouldn't. I'm Gary Nall, and that's 1 half our program today on health and healing. I'm going to come back in a moment, and I'm going to share some interest I have in the environment. We have a lot of listeners in California. In the past, for 36 years, when I was on KPFK 6 hours a week, every Wednesday morning from midnight to 6, I kept reminding people that you're in a beautiful state with lots of innovators, wonderful weather. Some of the most beautiful scenery in the world is in California. Some of the nicest people I've ever met from there. Laid back, easygoing. But also, you're living in a double-edged environment. Some of the best of life on the one hand, with some of the greatest risks on the other. Now, if you're able to get through life without meeting that risk, good for you. But what happens when it comes knocking unexpectedly and you're not prepared for it? In the last lecture I did in California, I mentioned this, that shouldn't you take some time, measured, not rushed, not panicked, from a calm mind, and ask yourself, am I now, in this stage of my life, living in the right place? Is there a safer place, a more sustainable place? Is there a place with better weather, not without drought, without the danger of an earthquake, or any other natural catastrophe like fires? And no one said anything to me afterwards. Generally, I'll get some feedback of people saying, well, yeah, I thought that was worth thinking about. Now I'm flooded, so I'm told. I have my IT person. I can't, so I'm not checking any of my email, but he said, Gary, you won't believe how many people in California are freaking out because things are out of control. So before I take my break and come back with some more information to share with you, as of right now, some of the fires have zero containment. There are over 25 fires just in Northern California. Now there are fires in Orange County, which generally doesn't get as many fires. Thousands of acres are burning, not controlled. And when I was last in Northern California, and I've driven the whole state of California many, many times, from one end, from the Mexican border, right up to the end of California. And the last time I was at a film festival, and then I was at I did a lecture, and I wanted to drive. I didn't want to fly. I liked to see the state. And I was commenting upon what I was seeing to the driver who lived there. And I said, you're really susceptible to fire up here. I said, look at all this. This is dry grass. And the artificial irrigation system is irrigating the wine or grapes. But this is a tinderbox. And he said, well, we've been pretty fortunate. And he and his wife and kids have lived up there for some time without any problems. Though they have experienced some severe drought. Everyone knew that there was a problem, but more and more people are pouring in because of its desirability for different reasons. Understandable. What happens when we take a place that has some things that are desirable, but also some things that are extremely non-desirable, and we don't look ahead at the likely outcome of making the wrong choice? We're wanting our desire. I want to live there for the following reasons, instead of what's the worst case scenario? And so right now, I did some measurements early this morning when I woke up. I took a picture from the New York Times. You can do the same thing. And the New York Times is claiming 1,500 homes in the whole state were burned. And I'm looking at one picture that there's over 2,000. Look at the square blocks. They show you the drone of the normal neighborhood. And this is densely populated. Normal suburb. And then they show you shortly after a few hours of fire. And by the way, some of the people are asking, well, you couldn't have a fire that intense. You know, nonsense. Most of those people had propane tanks. And you hit a propane tank with fire, it's going to explode. And it increases the intensity and the heat substantially. Every single dwelling burned to the ground. I mean, there is nothing but ashes. They even said that this was, quote, like an Armageddon, a fire. Every single house, nothing spared. So count. Do it right now yourself. Count how many. Remember, you have two streets on a block, all right? And then that's it. Now count how many streets you have going up and down, square blocks. And you're going to look at over 2,000 homes burned in one picture, only one part of one community, and they got 45 communities that are on fire. Where in the hell's the New York Times fact checkers? Why don't someone there do something that represents objective journalism? Wow, how wrong could you be? You've got major destruction up there. They say, oh, only so many people dead. How about all the people that are missing and they're missing from the fire zones? You're going to have a pretty good number of those who end up dead. So right now, this has to rank as one of the worst fires in the history of California. And this wasn't out in the country. But also I was thinking, I grow grapes. It's one of my hobbies. I want to see what will grow and how long it takes. I've grown grapes at my home in Florida for over 22 years. And the heat of that dry fire at 50 miles an hour is not just destroying every single vineyard in its path. It's destroying your primary root where all vineyard grapes come from. You have one primary root. You grow it and you grow it. You plant however many you want to grow in a particular line. And you bring these in from grafters or whoever's come from Europe. The reality is you're going to have hundreds to thousands of these original vines destroyed forever. There's no more grapes going to grow there of that from that vine. That means that, and I'll bet anything, there's no insurance for that. And if there is, it's not for the destruction of your primary vines. So we're looking at really bad outcome here. My hope is that this provides people who have not been adversely affected an opportunity to see what they can do to help those who have been. That's our first obligation, to give comfort and to give what we can, housing. If you have rooms in your homes, go up there, put the word out. Put it out in social media that you can bring people in, you can feed people. Look what just happened in Houston. Do you think people still have homes there? Nobody has a home in Houston. Do you think the ground is now dry and clean? The ground is totally polluted. Do you think that water down there is safe to drink? It's not at all safe to drink. Now Puerto Rico is reporting that a particular parasite is showing up, and a bacteria is showing up in the water supply. Hospitals that are functional, which are only 10% of the hospitals, under emergency conditions, are flooded with people with parasitic infections. This is just the beginning of it. It's amazing how we lose our perception of the significance because the news cycle passes over to some other disaster. So I believe that we all have a moral responsibility to help those people in California who need help, as we did in Florida, as Louisiana, as anywhere else where there's a disaster. And most people are pretty good about opening their doors, but the people who generally do not open their doors ever are the wealthy, educated, successful people in gated communities. Well, the people who generally open their doors, who were the people, who were the only people you saw out there? The so-called Hillary Clinton rejected deplorables, the rednecks, you know, the ones that we can stereotype but never spend an hour to know who they really are. And they're the ones down in Houston. Oh, and they were the ones also in Florida and Louisiana. Oh, and they were the ones in Mississippi. So we should all open our doors and our hearts and whatever we can do to directly help these people. The second thing we should do is take an honest look and say, what could have been done to prevent this carnage? A lot. I'll deal with that on tomorrow's show. And then, should we be allowing people to rebuild, knowing this is just the beginning of what's only going to get increased in intensity and number? We might be having two or three of these major types of events in the Gulf or other places per year. And right now, California, the entire state, is in a fire zone and could stay that way for a long time. At what point do we say we have to find a more sustainable place to live? But while we're looking at right now at California, why didn't we look for the last 3 months at Montana? Far worse fires, bigger fires, over 1 million acres destroyed in Montana, homes destroyed, and not a word. But let's look at what The Guardian is showing us. Brazil just had, right now, as I'm speaking, the worst forest fires in blamed on human activity in Brazil's history. Huge fires down there. And not a word. Not one word. The Arctic ice sheet just hit its eighth lowest minimum ever recorded. Now, what that means is that a ship, for the first time in history, was able to go, in human history, was able to go across the Arctic unimpeded by ice flow. I think it was in 10 days. Now, the Arctic, according to the Guardian, ice cap melted to hundreds of thousands of square miles below average this summer. And climate change is pushing temperature up most rapidly in the polar regions and left the extent of Arctic ice at 1.79 million square miles at the end of the summer melt period, meaning you had open water. For the first time, an icebreaker didn't have to go through to create a channel for a boat to get through there. And for those in Afghanistan, the citizens of Afghanistan, especially in the highlands, according to Climate Central, the central highlands of Afghanistan are whirled away from the congested chaos of the country's cities. Hills roll across colossal, uninhabited spaces, fringed by snow-flecked mountains and set against blisteringly blue skies. Farmers say unanimously that temperatures have risen over the past decade. Rain is very rare and more unpredictable. And for people who know about climate change, they know that it's changing in a bad way. As a result, you're getting drier and more famine in that part of Afghanistan, but the world doesn't know about it. And then there's Alaskan towns at risk of being taken by the rising sea. And according to the latest reports, the Army Corps of Engineers says that 31 Alaskan, remember, Alaska's a state, Alaska's part of the continental United States, right? Its communities face immediate existential threats from the coastal erosion and the flooding and the consequences of temperatures. A city could have been, a town could have been there for 100 years, but it was on frozen land, permafrost. Now it's melting, and whole buildings and houses are just tipping right into the ocean. It's all breaking off. 31. We don't hear a word. Last year was the hottest year on record. But we're not paying attention. Also, for the 37th consecutive year, alpine glaciers retreated across the globe. And these glaciers are the major source of water for most of the people on the world. And they're retreating, including places like Southeast Asia. Also, global sea levels have risen to the highest record that we have seen in our lifetime. Just a few things to keep you aware that we had better pay some serious attention to the environment. I'll be presenting in the very near future, hopefully next week if I have time, the most comprehensive, in-depth review of everything environmental. You would have to read at least 100 books to get what I'm going to put on the air in essay form. It's taken us over a year to prepare this. Richard Gale and myself will share it with you. And then you'll have a really good look. Not meant to scare anyone. It's not meant as an apocalyptic look. There's still things we can do. In some areas, there is not. With at least 22 tipping points, they're tipped. There's nothing we can do. And to the Koch brothers and to George Soros and to all the presidents of the United States going back who were aware of global warming and did nothing except posture, and to the average person, you're going to be faced with the results of that. What you're seeing in California now is a result. What you're seeing in Texas, Florida, Louisiana was a result. And that's just the beginning. So what do we do? I'll give you the solutions. I wouldn't give you a problem without the solution. That's coming. Now we're going to take a break and come back. Please stay with us. I like to change up the pace a bit and continue what I started a couple days ago by just sharing some thoughts of what it was like to live at different times in different countries and realize, my goodness, you actually have more conveniences today, even if you're the poorest American, than some of the rulers of the world, the aristocracies. They didn't have a refrigerator. You do. They didn't have a television or a radio or a telephone. You do. The things that we take for granted sometimes, like an air conditioner. Imagine being, as I mentioned yesterday, at the court of Versailles, and you had by tradition to wear all these garments. It was stuffy. It stunk. Every palace was, by the way, not every palace. Catherine the Great was, I'll deal with Catherine the Great and what made her such a unique and remarkable human being and why she brought culture and etiquette to Russia in a way that it never experienced before or after, with the possible exception of Nicholas the Third. But in any case, you had to stand there or sit there all day long, sweating, smelling, and eating, and almost everything they ate was unhealthy. Well, that was not the only thing. You also had the politics of the time of Henry XIV, an authoritarian who tried to control France absolutely and spread French influence around the world, and he was an absolute monarch. And this included his effect to dominate the church. By the way, as we know, France was predominantly a Catholic nation. He employed censorship, including opening the letters of all the nobles. And he would have anything read, and if there was anything gossip about him, oh, you were in trouble. The nobles were not aware that all their letters were being opened. And the king of Portugal sent him an elephant from the Congo. And where did that elephant live? You guessed it. The elephant lived in the palace for 13 years. Yeah, well, that would be something. And in mid-17th century, France was the leading European military power by managing to avoid the devastation of the 30-year war. And during his reign, three main wars, the war against the Dutch, the war of the League of the Augsburg, which was against the coalition of Austria and the Holy Roman Empire, and the Dutch Republic, and Spain, and England, and Savoy, and the War of the Spanish Succession. And he regarded war as a way to enhance his glory. And during peace, he only prepared for another war. Sound familiar? And War of the League of Augsburg is regarded as the first global war and included fighting in Ireland and North America and India. And Henry loved ballet, and he would play leading roles in his ballets, and in 1664, and also he played the Moorish gentleman and the Sicilian in 1667, and both Neptune and Apollo in a play in 1670. So they would get up at night in front of their people, and they would have a part in one of these, or they would have their poets, or they would have a philosopher, or they would have an artist present something or a new composition. But it wasn't different every night. It was similar all the time. There was a sense of tedium You did the same thing over and over again every day, and they didn't have television, radio, the internet to distract them, to bring them news and entertainment from elsewhere. And this particular ruler, I'm talking about Henry XIV, abhorred Protestants. In fact, he forbid Protestant preachers, and Protestants could not serve in the court or public office. And he told them, leave the country. That resulted in 200,000 skilled workers and business persons in the Huguenots, and 1/4 of France's Protestant population left. And that really decimated France's economy because they didn't have people to take their place to do these things. And France, like during Henry, was a bit like the United States, focused on fighting military budgets and building Versailles at the expense of improving the domestic economy. He didn't give a whittle about the average person. If you were living in poverty, and there you were, what was your life like at that time? It was bad. And food in France was meager. People would frequently sleep on straw at night. Frequently the poor would sleep on the streets or would sleep in barns. And you had no place to bathe, but you didn't bathe even if you had a place. You stunk. Animals were everywhere. And just imagine, because animals were everywhere and there was garbage thrown out and water thrown out onto the little roads, it was all mud. And you're walking. And if you got a dress on, all that human and animal manure or just feces is all over your dress. If you got shoes, your shoes are caked in it. Just imagine if you were to walk across a muddy lawn that had just torrential rain. It's going to sink in. You're going to get inside, except your lawn is not going to be smelly. This was smelly. And they ate out there. Most people didn't have a place to go in and have a meal. They would eat outside. The poor had to eat out in the weather, whatever the weather was. They had to find a place. They would eat. They would go by the fishmonger's market, and whatever was bad and being thrown away, they'd eat it. All right? If they had bread that was stale, they'd eat it. And they didn't live very long lives. They had massive parasites, infections. They died of bacterial and viral infections. Contagious diseases were rampant. But it was different if you were royal. The king and the queen ate in front of an audience. Mind you, you were invited to watch them, but you were not invited to join them. Marie Antoinette, she didn't like ritual, and she didn't eat anything. She would generally eat in private before, and she would not even remove her gloves. So she was kind of like a scandal. And depending upon your position, you'd be further back. So even how close you got to stand to watch the king and queen sample their food, so the whole chamber would be filled. And a dinner set for what was considered a full French style would consist of 283 pieces for about 24 people. And you always started with a soup. And then you would have entrees, but here in America, an entree is a single entree. Not there. You would have your entrees, which would include three or four other dishes. Dishes were served on gold and silver plates only. So if one of the entrees was a veal, you might have five different ways the veal would be served. Or if you had fish, you might have five different types of fish. And they would always have spit roasted and elements that were traditional and sauces. They did have salads, and they did have side dishes. And those came as separate courses. So if you had a salad, the salad you would have would be a huge salad. It'd be a whole meal. Well, how does someone eat all this? Well, you had permission to vomit. So you would go over and you would vomit and then come back and continue eating, gorging. And of course, every meal had to finish with a dessert. And So how many dishes could you actually eat at a meal? If you were in the royal court, you would generally have between 20 to 30 dishes at a single meal. And chocolate, by the way, which was first brought to France by Spanish conquistadors, was reserved only for the nobility and the upper classes. It took the French court by storm with its kind of fortifying aphrodisiac and energizing virtues. In fact, Marie Antoinette had her own personal court chocolate maker, and it was common to use orange blossom. And lower classes never knew what it tastes like because they didn't have a chance to try it. They couldn't afford it. But the reason so many people wanted chocolate all the time was because it was supposed to make men more able not to suffer from erectile dysfunction. And when I was at Versailles, I asked around. I finally found an old menu in one of the historical references. And when I look down at now and I look at the first course, and the first course they had, this is just the first course of Henry XIV, they had les hors d'oeuvres, a royal belletine of pheasant, then a pâté of la bauche, they had French deep sea scallops, they had lobster aspic, a froid. They had the pottage, they had beef, gold leaf spangles, pureed chestnut soup with truffles, bisque of shellfish from other coasts, pumpkin soup fresh from a royal vegetable garden. That's your first course. Well, hold on, how many more courses do you have? Well, you had a second course, you had a third course, and you had a last course. Okay, and you're talking about huge amounts of food, huge. And you'd have iced, they would bring in cold cheeses, hard-boiled eggs. These were all put in the salads. But then you had, what if you were just the average citizen? Well, average people, not the poor, average people, you had bread mixed with grains, generally wheat and rye. And these were coarsely ground on a millstone and cut into stalks. They were good. If you were a peasant, you had an opportunity to have a small plot of land and you could raise some animals, chickens generally, goats sometimes, sheep, yes. You ate this and you ate salted meats because salted meats could be stored for a long period of time. And what you lacked is you didn't get minerals, you didn't get vitamin C, you didn't get vitamin D, you suffer from scurvy, you suffer from dysentery. And you died generally around 25 to 28 years of age. And sometimes they resorted to foraging. They were so hungry, they would eat moss and grass. And thousands died of starvation. But there were different levels of poor. And tomorrow, I'll talk about what it's like. I'm going to go up to the 17th century poor person tomorrow to tell you about what their main food was. And if you were a poor person, what did you do? What kind of work did you do? How long did you live? What was your life expectancy? Well, what if I told you the life expectancy in the mid-18th century, half of all children died before the age of 10. The life expectancy in France was 25 years of age in the 18th century. What about in classical Rome? What about in medieval Islamic caliphate country? What about in Han China, late medieval England? How long did they live? Who lived the longest, and how did they get there? I'll tell you that tomorrow. But I'm looking at the clock, and we're out of time, so I want to thank you for taking your time today to listen in. And I got a special program coming as a fundraiser to help our sister station, WBAI, starting in a few minutes. For everyone else, have a nice day.